My name is John Height. I'm currently Head of History and Politics at Central Sussex College, a sixth form college, just over 30 years, but recently mainly politics.
Thank you. Please can you tell me a little bit about yourself, your home background, your parents and your schooling?
Well, the most significant influence probably my mother, who was a primary teacher. My father was a merchant seaman and a draftsman. I went to a direct grant school in Cambridge, went to York for 3 years, and then took another year off to get some experience of life outside education, working in the factory, did a bunch of PGCE, and been teaching in a variety of schools ever since then.
Thanks. Can you remember much about the way you were taught history at school?
Yes. And, although I enjoyed history, what I can remember is...
History at school?
Yes. And, although I enjoyed history, and he just came into the classroom and started talking straight away, either on British or European. And I don't remember saying anything in lessons. There were never any debates. The only variety was to read the textbook. Grant and Templey comes to mind, and to make notes on it. And I assume there would have been test essays. We never did any written work apart from essays. Of my lower years, I can't remember anything at primary school, but in years 1 to 2, I can remember making a monastery model. So that was obviously allowed lower down the school, but not when you came onto exams. I kept that, or I kept the grass as a towel for some years. But apart from that, I remember being taught in a lively way in English, but in history, presumably I wasn't, because I have no other memory of anything I did lower down the school.
So why then did you decide to become a history teacher?
Well, I think I wanted to become a teacher for a variety of reasons. I don't remember what my reasons were then, but I assume where I am now that they've been to try and help, you know, sort of shape young people's future, to create greater opportunities for sort of children. I don't think it was because of my mother, but you never know at that age. I may have been influenced by her sort of experience. So as I wanted to become a teacher, then I had to teach something. And in those days, you tended to go to university to do one of the three subjects you did for A-level. And of the three that I did, French and English being the other ones, I was most interested in history. So I went to do a history degree. I always wanted to teach the full range, so A-level. So I went to do a history degree and then into teaching, although... when I completed my degree, I made a major decision which I agonised over for a long time very deeply. It was a very close decision whether to go on and do further research, which my tutor was encouraging me to do, which would have led to ending up as a academic. Go on and do further research, which my tutor was encouraging me to do, which would have led a thing to do to go into teaching. So I went into and did the year's training as a PGC student at Sussex University.
So the influence on your enjoyment of history was it didn't come from any specific source at school?
No, I mean I obviously enjoyed the content which was the. 19th century British history for O-level, which I didn't particularly enjoy, but the sort of 16th, 17th century in European and the English Civil War, I particularly sort of enjoyed that. So that's what I really enjoyed studying, but the sort of 16th, 17th century in European and the English Civil War, I particularly sort of enjoyed that. So that's what I, and I really enjoyed studying at university, that confirmed my desire to teach history. My sort of memories, and we went round Rome and to Greece, and that fulfilled, you know, reinforced my interest. I thought the buildings were amazing, and I remember particularly my heroes were Spartacus, which is a theme that comes up in my life, the slave rebellion, and Leonidas the Thermopylae, which was a fascinating story, which I sort of loved, and also the myths, Achilles and Hercules, certainly not the political ideas of the Greeks. That's a later interest which I didn't have at the time. And the Eagle of the Ninth, I remember that, the absorption of a Roman legion in the barbarian north was fascinating through Rosemary Sutcliffe's novel, that was. So it was actually ancient history, I suppose, which inspired me to into history, and then I really enjoyed the more modern material.
Right. So how did you learn to teach history at Sussex?
Well, it was a great sort of contrast, because I chose Sussex because it, I think a few others, but it did have the focus on being placed in a school for 3 days a week throughout the whole year, rather than focusing more at the university level. On the other hand, I found the university experience very stimulating, and the school experience pretty shocking in many ways in terms of the way that history was taught. I mean, it varied. All the teachers were very pleasant, but one in particular was very sort of cynical. I always remember, because I was an idealistic teacher with all these new ideas. I wanted to be called John and to open up opportunities for all children. And I remember being very bored in a lesson on social economic history. And afterwards, the teacher sort of said, "Well, life is boring, so I'm preparing the children for life." And that stuck in my memory as an appalling sort of justification for what he was doing. Other teachers were very inspiring as individuals on the storytelling, but the actual methods used in the school were very traditional, talk and chalk sort of methods.
So how long did it take you to feel confident in the classroom then?
Going back to the university side, which just explaining why I found that so inspiring. I mean, I had two great tutors, David Barrell, the history tutor, who was very into original sources and challenging the students to sort of to think. And my personal tutor, Peter Abbs, who specialised in English, wrote fantastic stuff, believing that all children could access the marvels of sort of poetry and literature. So that reinforced my belief that what education could do for all children. And they were very sort of perceptive and kind and supportive people. So overall, it was a good experience. And you could relate what you experienced at school and try to use the new methods within the school to the academics at university.
About being confident in the classroom. So how long did it take you to feel confident?
Yes.
And were you trying out all those new ideas?
With limited, yes, because in the school you were allowed. Obviously the school, it's a practice quite common now. One of the teachers was paid to actually be a tutor, and therefore one had greater leeway there. I can remember teaching about James the First, and actually going in being James the First, there was a lovely contemporary comment about his various unpleasant habits and the way he dressed and looked, which I reenacted. So one did have that opportunity, that was, although I'm not a natural extrovert and sort of storyteller, when you're dealing with particularly younger children, then you're sort of, you have a natural sort of authority, even if you act in a peculiar way. But it gives you more confidence, and as you get a good response, then that reinforces your sort of confidence. So it was a gradual development. I remember spending hours when I had to teach something I'd never knew anything about, hours and hours reading virtually everything I knew about the topic to feel confident, and then of course what I needed in class was a minuscule proportion of that. So confidence is something that develops sort of gradually. I don't know when I felt fully confident. I mean, one always has sort of doubts about what one's doing and how well it will go down, but generally I had positive response from students.
So thinking back to those earliest days in the classroom and your first teaching jobs, what kind of history did you most enjoy teaching and why?
Well, I assume what I enjoyed was what I can remember. I mean, always, but generally, I suppose it's often teacher training, you're given the sort of younger children first, So I can remember teaching the Crusades and doing advertising posters to go on a crusade. I can remember teaching the Reformation and being Cardinal Tetzel, I think it was, going around selling indulgences, things like that. And one of the highlights, I remember, this wasn't in my training, but in my second job, my main job, which was at Crowborough for about 10 years, acting out as Henry VIII, dressed up with a dressing gown and a pillow, because I was the old Henry VIII, explaining to the students why I'd had six wives, with sort of pictures I'd drawn of each one, and things like that went down well. So I enjoyed that sort of side, as did the students, sort of trying to make things sort of lively. The social economic that I inherited as for the exam courses was less, gave less opportunities for that sort of thing. But I did like the some of the social aspects of that, particularly the Luddites. I persuaded the teacher at Tideway, the school where I did my training, to allow me to do the Luddites as a special area, and that coincided with my themes about, you know, the importance of challenging authority when it's justified, and that seemed to relate more to the students, to relate more to that, those sort of issues. So that's, those are the sort of more deeper, I suppose, the more fun things that I can remember.
Mm. Did you do any A-level teaching when you were in your first jobs, or was it mainly lower school?
Yes, I was even allowed in my training to do A-level teaching there. They'd just been used to, you know, dictation all the time, but given that this teacher, say, had a responsibility to train teachers, she was prepared to let me do some work for 17th century English history. I can't remember what I did, but I'd assume I'd have used various sort of documents. Later on, I did a trial of, Charles I, based on the contemporary records, a little booklet there, which I used. That was probably year three. I used that for in one of my sort of jobs, that sort of thing. So, and when I my first school was a temporary, because I couldn't actually get a job when I finished training, so I got a temporary one, just filling in a short-term vacancy. But when I got my main job at Crowborough, which I stayed for over 10 years, then I was able to do A-level teaching. I think right from the beginning they were, there was quite a bit of that available. I just replaced someone who'd gone on to be head of history somewhere else. So yes, it must be, because it was January. So I just slotted into his sort of timetable. And I really enjoyed that and found the students very responsive.
So can you remember what the syllabuses were that you were teaching before the national curriculum? Was it mainly chronological syllabus?
Yes, the at Beacon, this was the school that had most influence on me. I remember we had social studies in years 1 and 2, 11, 12 year olds, first 2 years. And that was great, because it was taught as teamwork. So you had lead lessons, which so someone came in and gave a presentation to say about four groups, and then you went off for 2 weeks developing ideas from a common task sheet work booklet. So that was very handy, obviously, coming in as a new teacher with the resources sort of there. And I found that worked extremely well, and it also, because I was just teaching, that covered geography, RE and history, so I had to teach things that I hadn't got much of a background in, but because the structure was fine and the students enjoyed that, and you taught that to your tutor group, so you got, you know, so you taught them for a lot. So I thought that was a very, very good idea, which worked well. And then third year you had a sort of standalone year before exams dictated things, which we tend to do medieval and Tudor history, but again more flexibility to just slot in things. So that was great, because third year was the last compulsory year of history, and the one you had tried to get it to be exciting for the students, so they chose history. And then the exams was social economic, which was O-level and CSE when I started, although from memory I just taught O-level, because there was one sort of classic old hard line, I think Second World War sort of trained sort of teacher, or post-Second World War teacher, who fortunately for other people took the CSE classes, and therefore, so I was mainly dealing with O-level and then A-level as well as the lower down the school. So it was a nice sort of mix.
In those first 2 years when you were doing the social studies, was the history curriculum a chronological one with, you know, Romans and then Anglo-Saxons and then Normans, or was it a varied one?
Yes, within that. I mean, we started with a simulation plane crash on an island, and sort of based on the Lord of the Flies sort of story and how you would survive, and that was the introduction to sort of early man. And then you went through, I remember we did Sumerian civilization, so we did, it was largely, you know, what you, you know, sort of, I suppose what they'd done at primary school, but sort of starting from sort of scratch, but, you know, looking at the origins of religions, so you looked at sort of myths at the time, and that led on to that, and then you did Crusade. So there's some really, you know, so things were largely chronological, but relating it to the geography and the RE. So I thought it was a very well designed course.
What about your O-level teaching? You said that didn't allow you much scope for change and development. So what sort of teaching styles were you using in the O-level classes?
Well, the big change took place when Chris Hinton came and introduced, after a year, the school's history project, which, you know, naturally fitted into what I'd been trained as and believed in as an approach. So before then, and that was probably about 2 years before then, I had actually tried to use, you know, sources because, you know, they were being used before SHP came along, but sort of as incidental rather than sort of a central sort of focus. So I used those because I just thought that, you know, my natural approach is to encourage students to develop ideas from material rather than to be a great provider of information, conveyor of information. So, and obviously in social economic there are opportunities there. And there, some of the economic aspects in terms of the technology, the industrial archaeology. So I remember I produced a steam engine, had a little diagram, was a working flat model of a steam engine, and I went round the various canals, etc., had some photographs there, and because I thought that aspect was quite sort of interesting. We didn't do any visits though, because that was something that had to be organised by the school, and the head of history was in his last years and didn't organise things like that.
So what in your view really switches children on to learning history?
Yes, well, I mean, it does depend on the age and the sort of the background and whether a student is basically a natural learner who feels inspired by what goes on in the classroom or is a reluctant student. I think all students are interested in the sort of narrative, the story aspect, which is not really my strength. I mean, I do it, and particularly those simulations I've identified, but the other aspect is the challenge, the thinking, the working out what happened and why, which is more where my natural instincts sort of lie. So you need to get a balance of both, but that's where I remember the introduction in year three of the little Tollan Man pamphlet that SHP had of what is history, which we used before we introduced the exams of the course. And I thought that was really great because, you know, it does give all students, particularly regardless of their ability to communicate on paper, a chance to contribute an idea which might be just as sort of valid as someone else's, and you introduce the idea of history as an explanation, possible explanation, rather than as definitive load of facts. And that does, you know, allow and require a more active involvement of students in groups in the class as a whole, as opposed to just sitting there listening to the teacher going on, which would be my experience.
How did your ideas about how to teach history develop over time, while you were at Crowborough, for instance?
Well, that, as I say, that was because this goes back to my training. The idea, because it wasn't my own experience as a pupil at school, obviously, the idea of source based evidence, because that was certainly established in the training scheme. So I tried to slot that in sort of, you know, through the old traditional approaches gradually, but obviously SHP sort of opened that up, and courses will give textbooks with a whole range of sources rather than just relying on I always remember using Guy Fawkes' signature in the Jackdaw, you know, before and after being tortured and things like that. And obviously the the wider access to the photocopier was a godsend, because Banders, even if you have the colour version, were very sort of limited in what you could do in terms of the original. But there's no substitute in that particular case, obviously, of seeing the original. And the challenge of deciphering that is a sort of metaphor almost for deciphering other sort of historical sources. So with access, and I remember you sort of, I don't know when, but when one had basically free access to a photocopier, and you could produce easily, you know, once you've got the master, produce large numbers. It also greatly helped with the reading, this particular A level, where obviously you could not just have a textbook, but you could have students using more. So you know, really, it sort of paralleled the greater use of a variety of technology helping sort of students, and the evolution of the SHP, which were trends I fully endorsed and found very fruitful.
Did you find that those sort of methods led to better understanding by students of the course and better achievement?
Well, I'd assume yes. The fact that I, you know, wasn't frustrated, and so I don't have any specific recollection of that moment. You think, ah, yes, this method sort of works. But generally, I mean, the history department at Kroger was very successful and popular. And you know, it was across all the teachers' approach to that by the time personnel changes had taken place. And history was, it's always a rival with geography. And I think we had twice as many people doing history as geography. So I assume that reflected the success, not just of my methods, obviously, but of the whole approach. And it was very much a team-based department, which I found very, very attractive and useful.
The introduction of GCSE in 1986 coincided with you moving to sixth form work. But do you remember the impact it had? Because obviously that was bringing in evidence and skills work to that level, or not? Was it just a seamless change because you'd done SHP?
Well, with SHP, because SHP was designed for to appeal to the whole range, and we certainly had mixed ability classes. So my recollection is that I was teaching, I'm not sure whether it was GCSE, well it must have been, because it was mixed ability groups I was sort of teaching, because that was in the end one of the major reasons why I basically moved to become a sixth form teacher, because I just found, although the ideal was that SHP should be accessible to a wide range of children, and I think it could have been inherently, it's just that cutting across the quality of what you're trying to do and resources, there is, for some students I found, that there was so many problems outside the classroom. I think they're outside the classroom. And despite all the sympathy and the effort you put in, there were some students who were making certain lessons I found really depressing, frankly, that with the mixed ability, because you had the able ones, and I felt I wasn't stretching the able ones as far as I should. I mean, I believe in mixed ability, which made it worse in a way. And then, because you were spending so much time, I can still remember some of the names of those sort of students who I had all the sympathy for, but you know, combining that with what was going on in my sort of lessons. And you know, after time I felt that was getting me down, so you know, from the point of view of my aims of becoming a teacher, I retreated into sixth form work.
Did you really see it as that, a retreat into sixth form work?
I did, in terms of, well it was positive as well. I mean, it's because I always enjoyed the sixth form, and I wanted to teach, as I was, an 11 to 18 comprehensive, so that you could have the mixture of both. But I've, you know, if I'm not happy with what I'm doing, you know, I sort of struggle with it. But you know, if I feel almost, well, ashamed of some of the things that happen in a lesson and what some students are getting from it, then I feel that you know, if I'm not happy with that, then I don't just give it up lightly. But I felt that, in a way, probably my talents were more suited in terms of teaching history to A level than to, you know, the alienated, disadvantaged students, which was the main reason why I'd gone into teaching.
Okay, how much has history in the sixth form changed then over your career?
A great extent, because when I first started teaching A-level history, I think the format was just four essays in 3 hours on, say, British and European on an outline paper. And then at its peak, you had such a variety. You had sources, you had coursework, you had individual studies, which I thought was great. And now it seems to me to be going downwards again in terms of the cutting of the course. Not the coursework, but the individual study. And the other great change, which again was partly inspired by, I suppose, SHP looking exactly now what are you trying to do in history, as opposed to just get conveying understanding, testing understanding of knowledge, was you know, the greater focus on assessment objectives, which I agree with in theory, but I think now it's gone so far that the that I, you know, we've abandoned the essay virtually. Well, not totally abandoned, but it's been cut down so much, and I think history now, the danger at A-level certainly is that it's just cut up into these narrow and not totally logical assessment objectives, and you have to focus on those, the whole examination, and certainly all the material from the exam boards and the marking schemes are focused on these narrow assessment objectives. Which I have to keep looking up to see what AO1, AO12, BA, etc. is, because they don't seem to me necessarily to be sort of logical. And I think that is really harming the understanding. It's distorting the natural teaching of history. So I think, you know, sort of probably about 10 years ago was the peak of A-level history, where you had a mixture of essays, you had sources used in a proper historical way, as opposed to means to test a particular objective, such that now when one's dealing with sources in the second year, one can't give any credit for the evaluation of the source, because that is done in the AS, and therefore explicitly you're, and I just think that's that is ruining the subject. That's a rather strong word, but it's harming the nature of the subject, and it's part of the trend now. Everything is focused on results. There's so much, and the examiners are seen as gods. They produce the textbooks, they write the advice, and students are, you know, teachers obviously with the league tables and all the pressure to get the results, which is the main form of assessing teachers these days, and therefore history is being distorted at A level, the sheer joy of it, sheer understanding of it, to probably, I'm exaggerating the degree to which that, but I feel very strongly about that. So basically history, you know, A-level history peaked in terms of a whole variety of forms of assessment, and now being killed by excessive assessment, and obviously the cutting it out into little modules, units which are assessed, and the sort of holistic aspects, the feel for history as a subject, which could have been maintained alongside all these other things with the individual study, but that's now sort of largely being killed, and you have these far narrower sort of individual study. And I thought that was the ideal for one of the ideals. There's no, you need a variety of forms of assessment.
Should we go back to the sort of earliest days when you first moved into A-level teaching in 1985, and you were concentrating on A-level? Can you remember how you were teaching at that time when you went into your first job in sixth form college?
Well, I inherited 18th century British history, so that bit I was just teaching for survival, really, and therefore it wasn't immediately apparent a range of stimulating material on Walpole, but I survived until the American War of Independence. Then I would assume, because I mean that's my natural approach, that I would have tried to produce some sort of some documents to look at the issues sort of there, even though there wasn't, from memory, it was just a four-question essay papers, yeah, on the grounds that this gets the students to think of challenges I explained before. Then we did have there was a special paper, I think I was in the Cambridge Board, where there was, you specialise in Britain 1815 to 51, where you had sources as part of the exam. So that was a major innovation for A-level and greatly to be welcomed, obviously. So that did naturally, you know, allow you to reconcile what you'd like to do as a historian and a teacher with what you need to do for the exam, and that's obviously the best combination when the two combined. I also remember teaching a totalitarian regimes JMB option, which was again largely, you know, sort of source based with essays, although sadly there wasn't a comparative question on the regimes in the version we taught. It was just looking at the regimes in isolation, which I thought was a bit missed opportunity.
Just wanted to ask you about this idea that you know, all students study nowadays is Henrys and Hitlers, you know, Tudors and Nazis. I mean, is that something that started to characterise the syllabuses that were mainly offered at A level? You just mentioned dropping the 18th century and moving on to totalitarian dictatorships. So.
Yes, I think the argument of dropping the 18th century is, for the British, is pretty strong, but that doesn't need to be replaced by totalitarian regimes, because I think there are, you know, I think 16th century, there's some fascinating issues there, 17th century British history. So, you know, I think... But to my mind, you know, that there needs to be some major issues involved that you can relate to, even in a different context. Whereas the factional politics of the 18th century, I find of all the things that you know, one should teach, it's there are so many other things for which you can develop so many other ideas. I'm not so. I don't think the content is well. I think content does matter. But that doesn't mean to say it has to be modern, but I think that you can develop the skills far more effectively in a content which has some issues and allows students to engage with it than something which is like 18th century political factions, essentially out of their life and doesn't really relate much to the modern world. So I do think that you know, you can have ancient, you can have sort of Renaissance, you can have a whole range of areas, but I think it's vital that there is something that students can apply what they're learning to relate to the modern world, and that the content, that there's large elements of it which are inherently interesting to many students, and you as a teacher, I mean, it does help if you as a teacher feel that there are great issues, because
we're ready with this one. You mentioned that you did teach the AEB 673 course, which was quite innovative at A level.
Yes, I mean, that was, well, I think it was parallel rather than inspired by SHP, but there was the same approach in SHP where you had some sources with just a very brief introduction to the context, and it was, you know, students were assessed on their ability to handle the sources without giving credit for any sort of knowledge, which I think did actually work well, and the evidence seems to suggest that a whole range of students could actually use those sources well. AEB had the same idea, and I felt that at A level, that although I fully applauded the use of sources, I felt that that was a bit false and not necessary. And that at A level, one could naturally just use the sources to illustrate on the topics they'd learned, and because obviously no historian analyses sources in isolation from the context. And therefore, although I think it was legitimate at SHP to actually, you know, sort of test the thinking skills of the students, I think at the more advanced level that wasn't that successful. On the other hand, I mean, the project, because the great thing about the AEB was the personal study, which was sort of very stimulating. I really think that at A level, even though at university, lots of places did not have a sort of mini dissertation or thesis operating, although York, where I went to, did. But that at that level, that's one of the greatest things that students can do in history education. And the experience was, and why I so enjoyed teaching it or training students to do that, was that a whole range of students classically could. So those students who might be not do that well on the an exam, timed exam essay questions, could actually put a lot into their studies. And that also applied to the London E syllabus, which we focused on, at Haywards Heath, which I, you know, that's why I greatly regret its loss. But I do think that that was very rewarding for most students, as well as for teachers actually having the opportunity to give guidance to students on an area they'd chosen. I think that's a great asset, particularly for, you know, the less naturally, say, gifted historians.
Just more about that, if that's all right. So are you saying that the course had a personal study, it had a document question without any background knowledge, and then it had papers that were essays as well?
Yes, so it you know, I think that's what you need, a variety of forms of assessment, and I think that balance. And so although I was critical of that particular source of documents, because I thought at A level you don't need to have documents in isolation of the context.
So did the essays, what topics were they on? What was the syllabus for the conventional part?
Well, I think it was variety, a standard variety. So I was teaching, well, I can't remember, I mean, I have taught, it would be either social or economic. I think it was probably 20th century political aspects that I taught, European history, that's my area of choice.
And did you then move from AB673 to London E?
Yes, I mean, at Haywards Heath we had AB alongside traditional outlines of papers, and then I mean, it must, because at first I wasn't in charge, and then I introduced the London E, which I thought was extremely good, because you had source based but context based questions, and then essays just on their own. And then you had the individual assignment, and you also had coursework. So I think that was the... Because they are different sort of skills. And I think that now, although coursework has been kept, I mean, perversely, my other subject, politics, coursework has been banned. So there's no coursework. Although they have got an opportunity to do research in the current London, and I think other subjects... it's confined within an area. There's not the freedom to choose, and I thought that it was great for a student to be able to have the choice to choose something totally outside anything they were doing, that they were particularly interested in, say, like particularly ancient history, something like that, for their A-level, and that's now been lost unless you do a course which has that aspect to it.
So did you encourage students to do a very wide range of topics and then support them with that study?
Yes, invariably you produce some suggestions for students to sort of choose from, and it did tend to be the more sort of academic who chose the more challenging ones, because you could do a study which had some relationship, but it couldn't overlap with the content too much, but it might be something they were familiar with. And obviously for those who were sort of weaker and less committed, then that was quite sensible advice that they sort of do something they've got some sort of context on, but there was careful monitoring that it didn't overlap, so it did give them opportunity to extend beyond what they'd done in their outline papers.
And did you mark those individual studies, or were they sent away to be marked?
Well, the London ones were externally marked. The AB ones were internally marked and moderated.
Right.
So I don't think that's crucial. There was, with both of them, initially there was a log, which was a very good idea, in as much as the students then recorded what they read when and their reflections on it. And then in the case of in the AB, they had to produce an essay, write that up into an essay about that, which I thought was a very good idea, but in the end it became a bit formulaic, and that was dropped in the last manifestation of the studies. But I think it's something that's inherent to it, that you actually need to give them guidance and structure, which they recall things through. But I think in the end the need to actually produce it, because I think it was about almost half the marks were for the log. That perhaps was it was rather false. It was needed at the time, but it was a rather false a division of the areas, and a more natural producing, recording your work for the final study as opposed to something that was formally assessed. That was a better balance.
Did you find that students doing that type of course were less adept at doing essays for the exams?
No. I felt it might be more the other way around. There were some students who were not so adept at doing essays, understandably, because that's a very, in many ways, a rather false, particularly the timed exam context of doing essays. I mean, doing essays without the time pressure and the exam pressure, I think, is a more genuine test of the natural ability of a student. Once you put it into a timed exam context, then it narrows down the range of students who can show their true worth. And therefore, there were students who did not do as well in the exam side, who did get far more credit and produce very impressive pieces of work on the project, the individual study side, which I think was a major justification for it.
Right. I'm just wondering whether you comment on some of the trends that have been happening in history recently, and particularly in relation perhaps to the sixth form element. Do you think it's important for history to promote a sense of national identity and to have a fair amount of British history in it to do that?
I'm a great believer that history is crucial for helping people to understand the world in which they live, and obviously the country in which they live is a part of that. So that's an extent, yes. So, but that would be, in a way, it's natural with Britain, given the nature of the British Empire and the impact we've had on the world. I'm not a great fan of over-relying on British history, and I must say my own interests lie mainly outside sort of British history. I think that history is important for students understanding the world in which they live, and therefore obviously the country in which they live is part of that. And so to be able to go back and understand the way their country and the world generally, but obviously you can't do everything. This contrast between, say, more conservative views and more radical views of history, I think, as many things, I mean, it's a mix that's needed. It's the same debate over skills and content, isn't it? I think that you need, you must develop the skills, and the content is a means to do that, but it's not just a means to do that. There's certain things which aren't confined to things which directly impact on national identity as such, which ought to be taught, and they can't all be taught, but I think that the combination should be that at the end students have come across issues about how people relate to each other, the dangers of sort of one group dominating over another's, the idea of injustice and the idea of how people have shaped their own future and rebelled against injustice. Are vital themes that I certainly would enjoy, and I think it is important that all people have some experience of, and history is a natural means to do that.
Do you think that that sixth formers that you've taught more recently have less chronological background, if you like, less understanding of the overview of history gained from their secondary school and primary school education, or is it not really any different to how it ever was?
I think they have less knowledge. I don't myself feel that they come up with sort of masses of errors of what came in which order. So I think that still they're, because in terms of their experiences, watching TV, etc., I've never found some sort of, I don't remember any great sort of anachronistic sort of statements like having TV back under Robin Hood, despite some of the films occasionally indulging in that. So I don't feel, I mean, I feel in a sense chronology is more important early on, in the sense when, this presumably is a concept that needs developing in children. It's not a natural development, and therefore at that stage, and largely I think the history syllabus are like that, isn't it? The primary level, although there are gaps, etc., there's a degree of chronology in that. I think that certainly by the time you get to the sixth form, if they've got some gaps, I don't think gaps matter, as long as they're basically got an understanding of medieval issues compared to sort of 17th century ones compared to 20th century issues.
Why do you think their knowledge is less?
Well, I think that's broader social sort of factors. I think that's the particularly, I think the decline of reading, the growth of alternative ways of sort of learning or experiencing things like the media, the internet, computers, things like that. I just feel that the sheer level of knowledge which might be relevant to what I'm sort of teaching as a historian is far lower than, I mean, I maybe view things with rose-tinted glasses, the golden age, as it were. But I do think, although students are, you know, sort of have different knowledge, as it were, in terms of how things operate, but I do think the level of historical knowledge is less strong than it was. But I don't think there's a major sort of block in a basic sense of chronology.
Why do you think that such things as the Holocaust and the slave trade have become dominant themes in secondary school curriculum? And, you know, do you think that history in the classroom should have a sort of moral dimension?
Yes, I think that basically history is a means to, you know, make people think about their lives, society in which they're in, to and the world they're in. And therefore, in that sense, in terms of how you relate to other people, is a vital part of that. So in that sense, I mean, it shouldn't be taught to teach a particular concept of morality, but just that, you know, history is about how humans interact with one another, and that is the vital thing, that that all people should have some structure in which they can develop their ideas about that. I mean, I think that's the main justification of history, that, and particularly things like, I mean, you know, something like sort of toleration, I mean, the issue of toleration, that you, because we are, particularly now, we are a very diverse world, and the fact that you should try and understand other people, that doesn't mean to say agree with them, but understand, you know, their views. I mean, that applies to Islamic fundamentalists, to racists. That's why I think some of the topics like the slave trade, I mean, how could one, without condemning the people who did it, I don't think it's useful to go around condemning people in the past. You've just got to try and understand how such events could happen in terms of the ways of thought of people in the past, and that applies also in the 20th century clearly to how people in the contemporary, what, 21st century, the current world, then can have different viewpoints. And I think history provides such powerful illustrations of how, you know, horrible things like the slave trade and the Holocaust and wars can happen and have happened in the past, and that's, you know, primarily why, you know, I feel it's issues like that should be taught, focused on as a major part of the curriculum, rather than, as I'm referring back to my bête noire of 18th century political sort of factions. I think that's, I mean, I could not conceive teaching history if it didn't have as a major dimension things like that, which I think could be used as a means to get people to think about things beyond themselves and how they relate to other people. And I think that, I mean, you can do that in literature, but, you know, history has the authenticity that actually happened, and therefore, because it actually happened, now how on earth did that happen, and therefore how could we perhaps try and avoid things like that happening in the future? It's a rather, I mean, just, you know, in terms of what one should teach, I was just sort of thinking the things I sort of teach, and they are, you know, fairly negative. I mean, my favourite area really is the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution, which to me are examples of how great ideas to try and liberate people go horribly wrong, which is a rather pessimistic sort of message, isn't it? And and things like the Holocaust, of course, that's a horrible idea that is sadly achieve some of its aims with Nazism. But to me, that is the, you know, the essence, the content essence, alongside the skills. I think the skills are great in terms of getting people to, I mean, obviously empathy can be deemed to be a skill, but there are the intellectual skills of, you know, thinking critically about material sources and refining, you know, developing an understanding of those, so challenging people. I remember going back to my influences, the one of the things that most influenced me as a teacher was a book, I think it was a Penguin Education special, called Teaching as a Subversive Activity. I can remember what the book, little white booklet looked like. Well, it was a book, I think. A book. I can't remember the author, but that didn't particularly matter. But that was not some radical tract for sort of a Marxist. That was to get students to challenge, and it wasn't, I don't think it was particularly historically based, but certainly it was very appropriate for history in terms of getting students to think, to ask the question why. I think, to my mind, the key question in history is why, which is goes back to my comment about not being such a great narrator of what happened. And my knowledge of the individual qualities in people's lives is not that great. Obviously, at the younger age, like I mentioned, James I, that's what grabs their attention. So you need to do that. But my impetus in history, my motivation in history, is to explain why things happened. And I think that's why history is so important. Because then I do believe you can learn lessons from history. You can use your understanding of history to try and make people's lives and the world better. But then when you look at the positive, so where have these attempts to make things better really succeeded, it tends to be rather sort of negative, I think. Because in terms of, consider who would I like to study as an inspiring example, not someone who sort of failed. I mean, Gandhi obviously comes to mind, but obviously, his death and the context in which that happened is a very mixed message in terms of inspiration. There's Martin Luther King, there's Nelson Mandela, but again, current South Africa is still a flawed society. And my sort of current focus on politics, of course, there's Obama, who hopefully may be different. But I think it's people like that, even if the end result is doesn't live up to hopes, but that is what life is like, sadly. And there are the great improvements, even if one doesn't achieve the heaven that these people are seeking for.
On a more mundane topic,
somewhat,
has technology made an impact on your teaching over the years?
Yes. Well, I've referred to the marvels of Banda, given the freedom to actually have colour on a sheet to actually interest sort of students, but then the liberating effect of just being able to not just photocopy things, but to actually scissors and paste and draw diagrams and just zip them off with no fluids involved. That's been sort of fantastic. I was a great fan of the OHF projector in terms of the visual dimension. Film strips I found extremely good. The EAV ones I remember were not so much the rather mundane sort of summaries, but the opportunity to just sit and ask questions about particular slides in the film strip sort of. And then TV, obviously, particularly, I think, some people aren't naturally very dramatic and exciting in terms of presentation. That's not my great strength, and therefore TV is a stimulus. And then to use questionnaires to get them to think about sort of content, because I'm happiest when I'm... And I think it's not just sort of personal satisfaction, but in terms of happiest in terms of feeling that I'm teaching students is when I'm sort of setting up a scene where they've got some understanding of an issue and then asking questions, probing their understanding again, to think about things. And I think that a whole range of TV programmes, documentaries, even if they're not specifically educationally created, I think, say, of the Nazis warning from history, the Arnold Foster, The World at War, some of those things, they're incredibly powerful programmes. Some of the material on the American Civil Rights, the Eyes on the Prize series, where you can actually... And there, I'm a great fan of the original footage, particularly on something like that, these days you have lots of the recreations. I have used... I think it was The Rise of Evil, a sort of a reenactment of Hitler's rise, which I think is a necessary concession, if you like, to getting the student's interest. But I think sometimes the actual original, just seeing the film of the white police putting dogs on the protesters and the singing, very powerful. So that has, you know, the easy accessibility of that, the fact you can just have it in the class. And now YouTube, I mean, I haven't used that as much as I should have done. But there's so much material there on YouTube, an amazing sort of amount, which small clips. So, but I mean, the time involved finding those things out, I think there ought to be some structure where there's more access, you know, more information about what is out there. But I think that's a great sort of resource. Yeah, and obviously Google in terms of research, I think in a way that's plus and minus, isn't it? Because, you know, the value of training students to actually research books and read chapters and skim chapters, all those vital intellectual skills, particularly obviously important for those going on to university, but not just for those, all those, realistically, they're the ones more likely to use it to a larger scale. So Google does, in a sense, make research so easy that has a perhaps downside. On the other hand, you could say that makes it more accessible to a wider range of students, and it's there and can be used positively, although it does have those negative, you know, potential effects.
Recent trends in the school curriculum seem to be squeezing the time available for history, but perhaps that's not true at A level. How highly rated is history in the college where you work?
I think in all the institutions I've worked in, fortunately, history has been highly regarded. I mean, at school, I think it depends. I mean, it helps if you have a large element of historians in the hierarchy, and by chance, certainly Beacon, both the two most powerful people were historians. But it also depends on, for those who haven't got that sort of plant in the hierarchy, it depends on the nature of the history that you're doing. And if you are doing the SHP, I think that, people from other professions can see the value of that approach to history as opposed to just telling people about what happened in the past. So fortunately, I think that's been the case there. And of course, at A level, it is still, you know, there's this great grading of various subjects of soft and hard. History has always been, you know, given great sort of status. And though some people sort of bemoan the lack of historical knowledge and argue that history now, with the use of sources, isn't as challenging and therefore as worthy of esteem as the old learn all your facts and regurgitate in 4 hours. It does annoy me that those some commentators who say that exams, you know, the history for students now is easier than it was. I think now it is, actually. I think AS has certainly lowered the intellectual content and the skill demands of A level. But I think at its peak, where you had particularly these individual studies, and you had a combination of essays, source work, and individual studies, in many ways that's far more demanding than sort of A level that I did, which was just based on one form of assessment. So I think, you know, despite that, I still think history is well regarded, particularly with all the growth of the new subjects, which like media studies and sociology, etc., which don't have the same street creds. I think it's surviving quite well in terms of regard.
Finally, if you could choose any historical topic to teach, what would it be and to what age group?
Yeah, well, in a way, I referred to some of those when I talked about the things, you know, say the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution. I think Black Civil Rights, I mean, that's because there you do actually, that does combine, you know, seeing the what we'd see as bigotry of the opponents of that. But if you take it up, I mean, sadly, the syllabus is all seen to end in 68 and rather than sort of go through to the modern day. But you do see there that change is possible, that, you know, there are these leftover attitudes which still exist, and that's the nature of history, isn't it? Different paces of development. But the, you know, that important message of understanding both sides, understanding the white racist as well as the black position, which is in a way easier to identify with. So I think subjects like that, which hopefully have a positive dimension as well as the, you know, the sort of teaching a lesson to try and understand sort of oppression. And perhaps the, I mean, more positively, I mean, perhaps the suffragettes there. I mean, that old comment that the suffragettes now would be horrified by how many young people don't vote when the effort they put into it. But there are those, you know, I mean, the world has been improved by people challenging the status quo. So it would always be something like that which can inspire people to challenge, you know, what they see as ill, to understand other people, and to try and advance the world and the country.
Thank you.